Regulating Adult Businesses Based on Their Secondary Effects on the Community, An Ohio Case Raises First Amendment Concerns, by Julie Hilden. On September 7th, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit issued its opinion in the case of 84 Video Newsstand, Inc. v. Sartini. There, the panel upheld two regulations regarding sexually oriented businesses that have been imposed by the Ohio legislature. In this column, I'll briefly describe the Ohio regulations and then consider two of the most interesting First Amendment arguments that were raised, although unsuccessfully, by the sexually oriented businesses in the case. The first Ohio regulation states that a sexually oriented business cannot operate between midnight and 6 a.m. unless it holds a liquor permit setting different hours for its operation and does not conduct, offer, or allow sexually oriented entertainment activity in which performers appear in the nude. The second Ohio regulation, known as the no-touch provision, essentially forbids contact by customers with and contact between nude or semi-nude performers. Violations of either of the regulations are deemed misdemeanor offenses under Ohio law. Before passing the regulations into law, the Ohio legislature heard evidence to the effect that, and made findings that, sexually oriented businesses are associated with adverse secondary effects, including lewdness, public indecency, prostitution, potential spread of disease, illegal drug use and drug trafficking, personal and property crimes, negative impacts on surrounding properties, blight, litter, and sexual assault and exploitation. Such effects are known as secondary effects pursuant to case law, including most prominently the U.S. Supreme Court's 1991 decision in Barnes v. Glenn Theater, Inc. regarding nude dancing. In Barnes, the High Court ruled that nude dancing falls within the First Amendment, although according to a plurality of justices, only marginally so. The Barnes case splintered the court such that there was no majority opinion. Thus, each of the various opinions is well worth reading in order to get a nuanced sense of the justices' views and how they fit together. Despite the splintered opinions in Barnes, the court's bottom line was this: due to the negative secondary effects that may follow when establishments offer nude dancing, such establishments can be regulated as long as there is evidence that they do indeed create such effects. In the Sixth Circuit case, after the district court granted summary judgment upholding the regulations at issue, the sexually oriented businesses appealed, raising a number of arguments. With respect to each argument, however, the businesses lost and the regulations were upheld without any trial ever being conducted. One of the two most interesting issues the Ohio case raises, in my view, is why a trial did not occur here regarding the secondary effects of the businesses' operations. Granted, the Ohio legislature had at least collected evidence of secondary effects before passing the regulations into law. However, the businesses argued that this evidence did not show that their own operations caused the secondary effects at issue. Rather, they contended, the evidence simply showed that the evils that the state described existed, but not that they were responsible for them. Thus, the businesses suggested that other causal factors could well have played a role, and even a decisive role, in creating these baleful effects. And indeed, the businesses offered their own contrary evidence from their own expert, suggesting that they were not the ones causing these effects. I believe that the presence of plausible evidence on both sides strongly suggests that a trial should have been held here. Moreover, not only were there two evidentiary sides to this story, but the Sixth Circuit panel itself admitted that the business's expert evidence was directly relevant to the central issue in this case, and if accurate, does tend to cast doubt on the Ohio General Assembly's evidence. Even by the panel's own description, then, this sounds like a case where trial would have been appropriate. The Sixth Circuit panel pointed out, in defense of its decision to forego a trial, that the standard that the legislature's evidence must meet in this context is quite low. But just because the standard is low does not mean that a court can simply assume that the standard would be met if a trial were conducted. The advantage of a trial, of course, is that it offers a search for truth, one that is based on the best rules that our society has been able to devise over time for ascertaining the truth. And in the First Amendment context, especially, we need to know precisely what the truth is before we accept censorship as a supposed necessity and blame mere free expression for society's ills. In addition to challenging the government's claim as to causation, the businesses also argued that the no-touching restriction in itself violates the First Amendment. In my view, this is the most interesting of all the arguments that this case raised, and the one that may have the potential for U.S. Supreme Court review. On this point, too, the businesses offered evidence, as the Sixth Circuit panel explained. Dr. Judith Hanna, an expert in dance and the communicative aspects of dance, testified about the messages that exotic dance performances communicate. Joseph Hall, who works with adult cabarets, also described communicative touching between performers, including in the course of skits entered into a national competition. But again, unfortunately, despite another submission of credible evidence by the businesses, the court saw no need for a trial, which would have tested the possible expressive aspects of the kind of touching that was at issue. This argument that touching while nude is expressive is, I think, quite different from the argument that was made in the U.S. Supreme Court's Barnes case, that nudity in itself is expressive. In Barnes, certain justices reasoned that there was no First Amendment right simply to be nude because nudity is not inherently expressive. In their view, nudity is a mere status, not an act of communication. Hence, standing around nude on a public beach can be prohibited and punished, consistent with the First Amendment. Thus, in Barnes, it was argued that the dancers' First Amendment rights were sufficiently preserved by their ability to do the very same dancing they had performed nude, but to do it in pasties and a G-string. There, certain justices saw nudity as a status, not an expressive activity in itself. And the status-conduct distinction is one that is deeply embedded in American law. But the Ohio anti-touching regulation is different. Touching, including touching while nude, plainly isn't just a status. It is obviously an action, and when there is an audience watching, it is surely an expressive action. Thus, the easy way out that some justices took in Barnes by deeming nudity a mere status and thus non-expressive and non-First Amendment protected is foreclosed here. That point gives rise to an interesting irony. Let's assume I am right that touching while nude, especially if it is done on stage pursuant to direction, is more strongly constitutionally protected than simply being nude on stage. Ironically, then, the very same observers who would be shocked by onstage nudity would probably be doubly scandalized by onstage nude touching. By this logic, the more offensive action, which in objectors' eyes would cause more harm, would also be more heavily constitutionally protected. In the end, I believe that one reason that courts have wrestled with the issue of nude dancing and nude performances generally and found this issue so difficult is that they want to protect high culture nudity, for instance, in the Broadway musical Hair, where the cast typically ends the play in the nude, but also ban low culture nudity, and that can't consistently be done. In my view, the businesses that lost before the Sixth Circuit should consider trying for Supreme Court review on their expressive touching argument, for it's potentially a strong one. Moreover, with the court's composition having significantly changed since Barnes was decided 20 years ago, the justices' analysis of the same issue may well be somewhat different than the analysis a different lineup of justices provided on a significantly earlier issue in Barnes. Julie Hilden, a Justia columnist, graduated from Yale Law School, practiced First Amendment law at the D.C. law firm of Williams & Connolly from 1996 to 1999, and has been writing about First Amendment issues for over a decade. Hilden is also a novelist. In reviewing Hilden's novel, Three, Kirkus Reviews praised Hilden's rather uncanny abilities, and Counterpunch called it a must-read, a work of art. Her website address is www.juliehilden.com.